Cyclops, her friends started calling her, as in, "Hey, Cyclops, you might want to keep an eye out for that rooster." The only one who didn't tease her was an underweight guinea hen whom the chicken had seen around but never really spoken to. "I don't think it looks that bad, actually," she said. "I mean, it's part of what makes you you, right?" The chicken had never thought about it this way and supposed the hen had a point. Though a missing eye was certainly nothing to be proud of, neither was it a reason to feel particularly ashamed. "We've all got our little quirks," the guinea hen offered. "Some are visible and others are on the inside, where no one can see them. Me, for instance, I'm super compassionate. Was born that way, I suppose. If I see someone suffering, it just bothers the heck out of me, no matter who it is. This worm, for example, got bitten by a centipede, and I sat up half the night comforting him until he died." "But he was just a worm," the chicken said. "Why didn't you eat him?" "Oh, I'm a vegetarian," the guinea hen explained. "Grain is good enough for me. But even then, I never have more than a few kernels a day. What with all the starving songbirds struggling to feed their families, it hardly seems fair to take more than we need." "But songbirds are trash," the chicken said, and the guinea hen laughed, saying, "Well, then, I guess we could all use a little more trash in our lives." She turned to admire a lark who perched singing on the low branch of a tree, and the chicken was struck by how thin she was and how her weight corresponded to a kind of inner peace. "Hello, little lark," the guinea hen said. "Are you having a nice day?" "What's it to you? What's it to you? What's it to you?" the lark sang, and as the guinea hen offered her calm, beatific smile, a hawk swooped in and seized her in his mighty claws. The motion was fluid and almost beautiful. No beating of wings, just an effortless glide back into the sky and toward the distant treetops. The lark roared with laughter, but the chicken used the incident as an opportunity to reflect and learn something. The hawk could just as easily have abducted her, but it did not. The question was, why? A less spiritual being might have taken a practical approach. The guinea hen was smaller and easier to carry, but that wasn't the answer, and the chicken knew it. The hen had been killed because she empathized too much and was strange to boot. "Everybody's different. Larks are worthy, too." She should have spent more time eating and less time running her mouth. That was the lesson here, and the chicken intended to follow it. From now on, she would consume twice as much and be twice as ashamed of her missing eye. On top of that, she would love the rooster with all her heart and go out of her way to criticize songbirds, who were all a bunch of thieving hillbillies. A month after the guinea hen's death, the chicken was so heavy her thighs chafed. Her ankles hurt pretty much all the time, and her neck had been completely denuded by the rooster, who'd had it with what he called that pissity-ass love-talk shit. Something had moved into the hole formerly occupied by her left eye, but she refused to dwell on it. What few thoughts she allowed herself to entertain were reserved for the big things, death mainly, and what might be learned in its aftermath. A fox stole into the henhouse one night and carried off the gray pullet, who screamed that she was too beautiful to die, even as he was tearing a hole in her throat. Vanity, the chicken thought, and she swore off grooming herself or examining her reflection in the ditch. When a good-natured and sociable goose was struck by lightning, the chicken stopped talking altogether, much to the delight of the rooster. Gloomy, they started calling her, and she spent more and more time alone. She was by herself in the henhouse one morning when she saw a snake glide toward a nest and swallow an egg. The entire thing whole. It hadn't been hers, but still, she had to wonder what the unhatched chick had done to warrant such extreme punishment. It hadn't existed yet, So harboring unnatural thoughts was out, as was being excessively vain. Having lived alone inside its shell, it could hardly be accused of being too social or of eating any less than its fair share. The egg's crime, as far as she could see, was that it had been brown and roundish. Just like me, the chicken thought. And in that moment, the farmer's wife came up from behind and grabbed her by the throat.
The Parrot and the Pot-Bellied Pig. When asked why she'd chosen to become a journalist, the parrot was known to cock her head a half inch to the right and pause for a moment before repeating the question. Why did I choose to become a journalist? Well, the easy answer is fairly obvious. Perfect recall is something I was born with. But I guess what really drives me is the money. That and the free booze. It killed her to follow this with, I was just joking about the money. The paper she worked at was called The Eagle, and she wrote for the Tempo section, which was later renamed Lifestyles, and was now titled simply Living. Most of her stories were little more than puff pieces. Interview the wealthy tortoise who'd shelled out money for the new speedway. Cover the benefit gala for feline leukemia research. For hip dysplasia, for ringworm, or heartworm, or the hookworm anti-defamation league. She wanted an opportunity to show her chops. And finally got her break when a pot-bellied pig took over as director of the local art museum. The Eagle wanted something simple, 300 words tops. But the parrot thought differently and scheduled a long lunch. Her guest arrived on time, and after ordering, they got down to business. So, the parrot began, it's a long way from Ho Chi Minh City to the much-coveted director's chair of a noted museum. I'd like you to reminisce about the journey a little.
I'm sorry, the pig said, but I've never been to Ho Chi Minh City.
But you are from that region, are you not?
No, the pig told her. Not at all.
The parrot ran her fat black tongue over the ragged edge of her upper beak. I don't mean to contradict you, she said, but I've done a little legwork, and it seems that you're officially registered with your health care provider as a Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. So let's turn our thoughts eastward, shall we, and talk about your past.
Technically, yes, I am a Vietnamese pot-bellied pig, the museum director said, but that's just a silly formality. The fact is, I was born in this country, as were my parents and their parents before them.
I see, the parrot said, and she scratched the word self-hating in her notepad. So, how will your ethnicity reflect itself in regard to our museum? Can we expect to see more Oriental art? A pricey new Ming Wing, perhaps? Some big Treasures of the Emperor extravaganza?
Nothing's planned, the pig said. But you wouldn't rule it out?
Well, no, not completely, but that's all I wanted to know, the parrot said, and at that moment their lunch arrived. It was she who had made the reservation, and in a flash of inspiration, she decided they'd go to Old Saigon. The fact that it was her idea would not be mentioned in the article, nor would she add that the pig had never in his life used a pair of chopsticks, and that he gripped them, one in each hoof, as if they were screwdrivers. During the meal, a few blades of lemongrass for him, a Mekong platter for her, they talked about this and that, but she wasn't really engaged, busy as she was dreaming up a headline. Museum takes on Asian slant was good, but she'd have to fight hard to get it past her editor, who despised what she called wordplay. When their lunch was over, the pig trotted back to the museum and the parrot headed down to the VFW hall, where she hoped to round out her article. There she spoke to a red-shouldered hawk, who hadn't actually fought in Vietnam, but who might have had the war lasted just a few weeks longer. I could have practically been killed over there, and now one of them is coming to my museum trying to tell me what art I should look at. I hear you, the parrot said. The article was due the following morning, and she stayed up all night to finish it. Her editor scowled at the bulk of pages, but softened after the first read-through, saying, "Good work, you, and maybe we should send this over to the city desk." The eventual headline was no masterpiece. Pot-bellied museum director stirs controversy. But the parrot was so relieved to move out of the living section that the paper could have called it shit on a stick and she wouldn't have cared. As for the pig, he wasn't nearly as upset as she thought he would be. Rather than threatening a lawsuit or demanding a retraction, he phoned to say that he was disappointed. "Deeply disappointed," were his exact words. The parrot reached for her pen, hoping for quotes that might lead to a second article. "Is that all you have to say?" she asked. And in response, he sighed and gently hung up the phone. "Hello," the parrot said. "Hello, hello." The pig would not have admitted it, but what really bothered him was the pot-bellied business. He had been plump all through his youth, and the years of name-calling had not just shaped his adult life, but deformed it, like some cell made crazy by radiation. He couldn't remember the last time he had eaten without thinking, popped a passing canapé into his mouth, finished an entire potato chip or dry roasted peanut without calculating the damage. While others prepared for bed, he ran a treadmill. They tucked into their ample breakfasts, and he hung upside down from a bar in his living room, doubling at the waist until he saw stars. Then came the traditional sit-ups and half a slice of dry Ryvita before examining his silhouette in the hallway mirror and getting ready for work. His waist size was 28. His body fat index was 2%. He did not have a pot belly. He would never again have a pot belly. Now here was this article essentially comparing him to the Buddha. After hanging up on the reporter, the pig began a 3-day fast. Lunchtime came, and as his colleague shuffled to the museum cafeteria, he sat at his desk and looked out the window at that stupid hawk marching back and forth with his picket sign. The veteran had hoped that others might join him, but none of his fellows seemed to care. "The war is over and it's time to move on," they'd been quoted as saying. "Who cares if some..." And there was that word again. "Who cares if some pot-bellied Charlie wants to hang pictures on a wall?" Damn that parrot from the Eagle. The pig's anger felt vaguely nourishing, but he knew it was misplaced. The reporter hadn't assigned the animals their names. That was someone else's doing, someone who sat back and ordained. Large-mouthed bass, humpback whale, lesser wart-nosed horseshoe bat, not caring whose life was ruined. By the time he next ran into the parrot, the pig had lost close to 10 pounds. They met at a museum benefit, a costume ball that he hosted and that she hovered on the edges of, guzzling rum punch and gathering quotes she'd heard 1,000 times before. Wonderful party, and of course it's for such a good cause. The parrot was, she liked to joke, back with the living, by which I mean section, not the sensation of being alive. She'd assumed that the pig would be in disguise, and was surprised to see him in the same dark suit he'd worn at the restaurant. He was standing at the bar, nursing a glass of water, and she came from behind and tapped him on the shoulder. "Let me guess," she said. "You're Henry Bacon, right?"
"Who's he?" the pig asked.
The parrot rolled her eyes. "American architect? Designed a little something called the Lincoln Memorial?"
"Oh," the pig said, "that Henry Bacon."
He was going to admit that he was no one, or at least no one special, when the parrot stepped back and examined him again over the rim of her punch glass. "I've got it," she said. "You're Luther Ham. Took the silver medal for 400-meter freestyle, Helsinki, 1952. Little wisp of a thing, but boy, did he have shoulders."
"Right," the pig said. "So, who are you supposed to be?"
The parrot shrugged and held up her glass for a refill. "I thought I'd go all out and come as a 2-bit journalist." For verification, she presented an ink-stained claw, the nails of which were bitten to the quick. "So, hey," she added, "I'm sorry about the article. I haven't been that irresponsible since I worked in pirate radio. Broadcast journalism was never my thing, but you know how it is sometimes. You get pegged."
"That's all right," the pig told her.
"All right for you," the parrot said. "I'm the one with a goddamn hawk calling me every 10 minutes. Now he wants to go after Middle Easterners. Heard of a Persian cat who runs a parking garage down by the Civic Center and is after me to write an expose." The pig laughed for the first time in months and then looked down to see the parrot's wing resting on his stomach. "Is it my imagination? Or have you lost some weight?"
"No," he told her. "I mean, yes, I did. It's not your imagination."
He thought of how kind it was for her to mention it, and then he noticed how oddly satisfying it felt to be patted down by a wing. Meanwhile, the parrot was still talking. "Don't get me wrong," she said. "I have seen a cockatoo in my time, but I'm not dating anyone now, if that's what you're wondering." She grabbed a passing appetizer, dumped the caviar back onto the tray, and ate only the cracker. "A cliché, I know, but fish eggs make me bloat."
"It's the salt," the pig told her.
He'd hoped to say something more interesting, but just then the band started up. A wolf in sheep's clothing called out for a foxtrot, and as if a switch had been thrown, the party came to life. Here was the hare in cat's pajamas dancing with a chameleon whose costume changed with every turn. The ugly duckling cut in on a swan. A trio of mice lowered their sunglasses, and as they scoured the floor for partners, the parrot turned to the pig and held out her claw. He accepted it awkwardly in his hoof, and so began what the reporter would later refer to as her days of swine and neurosis.
Hello, Kitty. It was the stupidest thing the cat had ever heard of, an AA program in prison. Like he could find anything decent in here anyway. But if it would get his sentence reduced, well, all right, he'd sign up. Dance the 12-step, do whatever it took to cut out early. Once he was free, he'd break into the nearest liquor store and start making up for lost time. But between now and then, he'd sit with the sad sacks and get by with a little aftershave. The only thing he wouldn't do was speak at one of the meetings. As a rule, they were strictly Dullsville. Yammer, yammer, yammer. But every now and then, someone would tell a decent story. This mink, for example, who'd swapped his own pelt for a bottle of Kahlua. The cat didn't know you could survive without a pelt, but apparently it was possible. Not pretty, that was for damn sure, but it could be done, and this mink was living proof. It helped that he had a sense of humor about it and told his story with a little pizzazz, complete with sound effects and different voices. When he came to the bit about his wife mistaking him for a beef tongue, the cat laughed so hard he fell out of his chair. "Thank you," the mink said at the end of his little speech. "You've been a terrific audience. Now, don't forget to tip your waitress." After the meeting, the alcoholics congregated for treats washed down with burnt coffee. The cat was just going back for a second cup when he overheard a mouse talking in a low voice to the bullfrog who served as the prison chaplain. "He might be amusing, but I don't give that mink a snowball's chance in hell. In here, all right, but out in the real world, he's a ticking time bomb." The cat didn't know what this mouse was in for, but he was willing to bet it was something boring. Fiddling with his taxes or mail fraud. He wouldn't know a good time if it slapped him between the ears, but here he was, ragging on the hairless mink. "Refuses to take his recovery seriously. A classic example of a dry drunk." Give the guy a break, the cat thought. The poor bastard is permanently naked. His wife left him. His chop shop was confiscated. So who the hell cares if he starts drinking again? It beats wasting time with the likes of you. The cat didn't say any of these things, but he thought them, and it must have shown on his face. "Do you have a problem?" the mouse asked. And the cat said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do." Sensing trouble, the chaplain moved between them and held out his webbed hands. "All right, gentlemen," he said. "Let's just take this down a notch." "I've got a problem with certain rodents," the cat continued. "The kind who think that unless you're as pompous as they are, you're going to wind up on the trash heap." "Is that so?" the mouse said. "Well, I got a problem with cats who try to take someone else's inventory before they've taken their own." He was a spunky little thing, you had to give him that. Here he was, no taller than a shot glass. Yet he was more than willing to mix it up, and with a cat, no less. "Don't think I'm going to forget this," he said as the chaplain pulled him back. And the cat said, "Oh, I'm so scared." When dinner time came, the cat joined the mink for burgers and fries in the prison cafeteria. The mouse was on the opposite side of the room, sitting between a rabbit and a box turtle at the vegetarian table. And every few seconds, he'd look up from his plate and glare in the cat's direction.
"I don't know what's going on between you two," the mink said, "but you'd better find some friendly way to straighten it out. I'm telling you, brother, you do not want that mouse as an enemy."
"What's he gonna do?" the cat said. "Steal the cheese off my hamburger patty?"
"I don't know what he's going to do, but I know what he did do," the mink said, and he leaned his raw, seeping head across the table. "They say it was arson. Chewed through some wires and set a police building on fire. 4 German shepherds killed on the spot, and 2 more so burnt their own mothers wouldn't recognize them. Now, I don't know what you'd call it, but in my book, brother, that's cold."
The cat dragged a fry through a puddle of ketchup. "Dogs, you say?" The mink nodded. one of the burnt ones, was 2 weeks from retirement. Had him a party lined up and everything. You're breaking my heart, the cat said. The next AA meeting started like the rest of them. Not a decent story to be had. Someone said he was dying for a drink, and then someone else said the same thing. When that got repetitive, a member told the group why he wanted a drink.
Anyone else like to share? The chaplain asked. Any new voices we haven't heard from?
The cat closed his eyes. He usually drifted off to sleep and came to during the serenity prayer. But today he stayed awake, waiting for the mouse to pipe up and say something stupid like, easy does it, or fake it till you make it. Aphorisms he couldn't go 2 minutes without repeating. Boys, he'd say, when things get tough, I just have to remind myself to let go and let God. Then everyone would act as if they hadn't heard this 5,000 times already, as if it weren't printed on flea collars, for Christ's sake. Today, though, the mouse skipped the slogans and talked about a recent encounter that had tested his resolve. I won't name names, but this was between myself and the sort of individual I call a nosy Parker, the kind who likes to creep around and listen to conversations that are none of his business. That's how he gets his kicks, see? The cat said, why, I oughta... And the chaplain pointed to a sign reading, no cross talk. Of all the rules, this was the lousiest, as it meant you couldn't directly respond, even when someone was obviously trashing you. Now, I didn't know this individual from Adam, the mouse continued. I'd seen him around, sure, but aside from his plug ugliness, there was no reason to take much notice. He was clearly no smarter than this chair I'm sitting on, but that didn't keep him from running his mouth. In fact, it was just the opposite. Pushed every button I have, he did. And just as I was about to rearrange his face, I remembered my fourth step and let it slide. There was a general murmur of congratulations, and the mouse acknowledged it. I can't say I'll be so forgiving the next time, but I guess I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. Then a goat raised his hand and recalled getting drunk at his nephew's bar mitzvah. A guinea pig said some crap about insecurity, and a leech wondered if the big book came in an audio version. He'd just finished talking when the cat stuck his paw into the air saying, hey, everybody, I got a little story to tell.
That's not the way we do things here, the chaplain said. Before you speak, you have to introduce yourself.
Okay, the cat said. I'm a cat, and I got a little story to tell.
You know what I'm talking about, the chaplain said. Come on now. It's not going to kill you.
The cat stared across the table at the mouse and saw the same expression he'd observed the night before in the cafeteria. Smirky, defiant, the look of someone convinced that he had already won. All right, the cat said. I'm a cat, and... Oh, to hell with all of you. The mouse put his little hand over his heart, as if to say, you're killing me. And the cat pounded his paw on the tabletop. I'm a cat, all right? I'm a cat, and I'm a goddamn alcoholic. You happy now? Then everyone said, hello, cat, and waited, their eyes politely downcast, as their fellow drunk, an official one now, struggled to regain his composure. So that's how I met my first sponsor, the cat would later say. This at meetings in damp church basements and low-slung community centers, years after he was released from prison. That little SOB saved my life. Can you beat that? A murderer, an arsonist, and not a day goes by when I don't think about him. It maybe wasn't the best story in the world, but as the mouse had told him on more than one occasion, it wasn't the worst either.
The Grieving Owl. I was flying past a house the other evening, and because the lights were off and there were no curtains on the ground floor windows, I stopped to take a peek inside, which I do sometimes just to see how people decorate. This particular place was made of stone, not old, just made to look old, with a reproduction carriage lamp in the front yard, and one of those roofs that appear to be slate but are actually made of recycled rubber. From the outside it screamed, "Wagon Wheel Coffee Table," but it turns out they had some pretty nice furniture, at least in the living room. A lot of painted pine. English, from the looks of it. From there I peered into what's called the den. That's a room where people go to be themselves, or at least some idea of themselves. You see a lot of boats in dens, but in this one the theme was owls. Not real ones, I don't think I could have handled that, but representations, both flat and three-dimensional. Screech owl andirons. A candle in the likeness of a white barn owl. Above the mantel was a rather clumsy painting of a snowy owl hovering above a cross-eyed ferret. And on the desk, a small figurine of a great horned owl. Take away its glasses and the mortarboard cocked just so on his head, and it was me. Or perhaps I'm being too egotistical. It wasn't just me. It was my mother, my brother, my sister and cousins. Everyone, basically, who I'm trying to get away from. It's not just that they're stupid, my family. That I could forgive. It's that they're actively against knowledge, opposed to it the way that cats, say, are opposed to swimming, or turtles have taken a stand against mountain climbing. All they talk about is food, 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 which can be interesting, but usually isn't. There are, of course, exceptions. I once had a fascinating conversation with a seagull, who was quite the authority on the subject of the French fried potato. I always thought they were all the same, but not so, apparently. To hear her tell it, the taste varies according to what sort of oil is used. I said, "What sort?" Who knew there was more than one kind of oil? Then there's the question of texture, with crisp on one end and soggy on the other. The type of potato makes a difference as well, as does its age and exposure to the elements. Following our talk, I went on a restaurant jag. Every night I'd pick a new one and look through the windows into their kitchens. What I saw, aside from the ovens and so forth, were a lot of mice. This kept me going back to restaurants, and led to an encounter the night before last in the parking lot of a steakhouse. There I came upon a rat making his way toward the back door. "Not so fast, friend," I said. One of the things an owl learns early is never engage with the prey. It's good advice if you want to eat and continue to feel good about yourself. Catch the thing and kill it immediately, and you can believe that it wanted to die. That the life it led, this mean little exercise in scratching the earth or collecting seeds from pods, was not a real life, but just some pale imitation of it. The drawback is that you learn nothing new. So this rat, it was as if he were following a script. "I just swallowed some poison," he claimed. "Eat me, and you're destined to die as well." It's embarrassing to hear such lies. To think they think you're dumb enough to believe them. "Oh, please," I said. The rat moved to plan B. "I have children, babies, and they're counting on me to feed them," I said to the guy. "Listen, there's not a male rat in the history of the world who's given his child so much as a cigarette butt, and don't try to tell me otherwise. In fact," I went on, "from what I hear, any baby of yours has a better chance of being eaten by you than fed by you." "True enough," the rat admitted. His body relaxed beneath my talons, and I felt his hope leak onto the asphalt, as surely as if it were blood or urine. "I'll make you a deal," I said. "Teach me something new, and I'll let you go." "This is a joke, right?" the rat said. "No," I told him, "I mean it. You tell me something, and if I find it interesting, I'll release you." This was how I'd learned about dens and English furniture, about roof tiles and vegetable oil and reproduction carriage lamps. "All right," said the rat, and he paused, thinking. "Did you know that all this restaurant shrimp are frozen?" "No, I didn't, but that's not really good enough," I told him. Nothing that goes on in a steakhouse would surprise me, especially if it's a chain. You need to think further afield. Okay, he said. And he told me about the time he tried to have sex with his mother. How is that supposed to help me be a more well-rounded individual? I asked. Don't you know anything important? Then he told me that there's a certain kind of leech that can only live in the anus of a hippopotamus. Get out of town, I said. No, honest, he swore. I had an uncle who lived at the zoo, and he heard it firsthand from the hippo herself. It was one of those things so far-fetched it simply had to be true. All right, I said, and I lifted my foot off his back. You are free to go. The rat took off across the parking lot, and just as he reached the restaurant's back door, my pill of a brother swooped down and carried him away. It seemed he had been following me, just as a week earlier I'd been trailed by my older sister, who ate the kitten I had just interrogated. The one who taught me the difference between regular yarn and angora, which is reportedly just that much softer. Who's a smart one now? My brother hooted as he flew off over the steakhouse. I might have given chase, but the rat was already dead, done in, surely, by my brother's talons the second he snatched him up. This has become a game for certain members of my family. Rather than hunt their own prey, they trail behind me and eat whoever it was I'd just been talking to. It saves me time, my sister explained after last week's kitten episode. With the few hours she saved, I imagined she sat on a branch and blinked. Not a thought in her empty head. After my brother took off with the rat, I flew to a telephone pole on the far end of the parking lot. A leech that lives in the anus of a hippopotamus. Talk about a closed society. What must it be like to live like that? Your family within spitting distance your entire life. My next stop was the city zoo. I've heard there are some that house the animals in actual landscapes, fields and jungles and the like. Ours, I discovered, is more old-fashioned, geared toward the viewer rather than the viewed. The panther's cage is about the size of an 18-wheel truck. Our lions have it a little better, but then there are two of them. I don't know how much territory a hippo might require in the wild, but here at the zoo, her pen is on the small side, not even as big as a volleyball court. There's a pool for her to submerge herself in, and the ground around it is paved in cement. A sign in front of her display reads, Lois. But that, she explained, was just her slave name. No, I don't go by anything. Not now, not ever, she told me. That's just not the hippo way. What struck me right off was her warmth and accessibility. You expect this with miniature goats, but hippos, I'd heard, were notoriously grumpy. Oh, I have my moments, this one said. And she started talking about her teeth. They looked like pegs hammered at random into her gums, and it seemed that one of them had been giving her trouble, which is not to make her sound like a complainer, far from it. It's not all bad living in the zoo, she told me. True, I don't have much space, but at least it's all mine. For a while last year, they brought in a male, trucked him over from some wildlife center in the hopes we'd get it on and have a baby, but the pregnancy didn't happen, which was fine by me. It's not that I don't want kids. I just don't want them now, if you get what I'm saying. Sure. So anyway, how about you? I told her that great horned owls hook up for life, a rarity in the bird world. My mate passed away before our first clutch of eggs could hatch, but I learned a while ago that it's best to keep this to myself. A mood killer is what the seagull diplomatically called it. And it's true. Someone tells you his mate died, was struck by an ambulance, no less, and of course it casts a pall. That's why I didn't mention it to the hippo. I wanted to spare her the awkwardness. What else did we talk about the night we first met? I remember she asked what the land surrounding the zoo was like. She thought it was all trees and winding paths, little wooden huts selling balloons and cotton candy, that everything looked like what she saw from the bars of her pen. The hippo didn't know about muffler shops and office supply superstores, about restaurants and motels and apartment complexes with pools lit by underwater lamps. What does the world look like? Well, I told her that is going to take a while. That's what I was hoping, she said. On my way home that night, I picked up a rabbit. It was on the small side, and no sooner had I started eating than my mother appeared. I'll wait till you're finished, she said, in that particular way that means what kind of a son can't offer his mother so much as an appendage. Sighing, I ripped off an ear and passed it over. You shouldn't have, she said. Then, her mouth full, she brought up one of my cousins, who's single and will soon reach breeding age. Despite my opposition, my mother is determined to find me a new mate. There's been talk, she keeps saying. But what talk? From who? My former mate had been dead for all of 3 days when my mother set me up with the daughter of one of her neighbors. We met at dawn in a big oak overlooking a pasture. Below us on the grass, a white calf took her mother's teat in her mouth, and my date shouted, "Faggot!" I think the word you're looking for is lesbian, I said. Though even that wouldn't make sense. What they're doing isn't sexual, it's called nursing. It's the way mammals feed their young. She said, "Yeah, faggot mammals." When I told this to my mother, she looked at the bloody rabbit I was holding and said only, "What about the other ear?" Then she swore that this new female, my cousin, was different. I told her you'd meet her tomorrow night on top of the cross in front of God, Saint Christ Jesus, Lord. This is her name for the Catholic Church, which is actually, I've told her 1,000 times, called Saint Timothy's. Not that it mattered in this case. At 11 o'clock the following evening, I was back at the zoo, talking to the hippo. We started that night by discussing the pigeons and sparrows who come in the day and defecate on the concrete surrounding her pool. Disgusting, she said. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a goddamn she caught herself. Birthday. You can't stand birthdays? It's the fuss, she said. I mean, who needs it? Listen, I told her, don't worry about hurting my feelings. With one or two exceptions, I'm not much for birds either. Then I told her about the seagull I'd met, the one who taught me about French fried potatoes. A while after her, I ran into a rat who said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a certain type of leech that can only live in your, rectum. I don't know if that's the only place they can live, but I know I've had him back there for a good 9 months, the hippo said. Little sons of bitches is what they are. I think I picked him up from that 2-bit Romeo they sent from the wildlife center. Do they hurt? Not so much, she said. It's more the principle, if you know what I mean. The idea that they can just live inside me, rent-free, like they own the place. She looked behind her as far as she could. Then, too, they're loud. You can hear them talking? Not the exact words, she said. It's more of a constant low-level murmur. It's even more noticeable when I'm underwater. What do you think they talk about? I asked. Oh, regular asshole things, the hippo said. I don't mean things about my asshole, but the sorts of things that low-life assholes are interested in. Incest, maybe, or cards. Cards? She nodded her massive head. The men who clean my pan like to play them on their breaks. Sometimes they sit on the bench beside the snack hut and I watch. Off in the distance, the panther screamed. Then I heard a police siren. If you wanted, I could maybe listen to what they're saying, I offered. I don't know that I want to give them that much importance, the hippo said. Fair enough, I told her, and I tried to tamp down my disappointment. How can you not want to know what your parasites are talking about, I wondered. What if what they're saying is cruel, she continued. It's bad enough having them in there, but if they're literally making fun of me behind my back, it would be too much to bear. It's equally possible they could be trying to thank you, I said. I mean, just because they're leeches doesn't mean they're ungrateful. Isn't that sort of exactly what it means? She asked. I had just conceded her point when her curiosity got the better of her, and she agreed to take me up on my offer. If what they're saying is awful, though, I don't want to know the specifics. There was a short concrete platform near the front of her pen. and at her suggestion I stood upon it while she backed up. This brought her bottom level with my head, which I then cocked and brought as close as I could to her anus. "Raise your tail," I said. The hippo did, and I heard what sounded at first like a rabble, many voices talking over one another. Then I realized that they weren't talking. "Let me get this straight," the hippo said when I explained what was going on. "Leeches are singing inside my asshole." "To the best of my knowledge, yes," I told her. "It's so much fun in there that they've broken into song." "It could just be the way they communicate," I offered. "I mean, maybe this is what they do when they're sad or angry." It didn't sound much like a dirge, though. More like a German drinking number. "I want them out, and I want them out now," the hippo said, her voice so forceful the platform trembled. "Look," I told her, "there's obviously nothing we can do right this minute, so let's both sleep on it and see how things look tomorrow night." On my way home that evening, I swooped low over a suburban driveway and caught what turned out to be a gerbil. Funny-looking thing. Slight, with a brush-like tail and a scrap of red fabric around her midsection. I'd planned to grab a quick bite and go home to bed, but something this potentially interesting, it would be a shame to just kill it. "Hold on, friend," I said. And after her brief and pointless struggle, I learned that she was an escaped pet. An only child had kept her prisoner in her bedroom and was attempting to dress her in a doll-sized bikini when the gerbil bit the girl on the hand and made a run for it. "For a few hours, I hid beneath the refrigerator," she told me. "That seemed too obvious, though, so I moved into a copper pipe in back of the hot water heater, the old disconnected one they keep in their mudroom, the slobs." It was so much new information. A mudroom. A bikini. A hot water heater. How big was the pipe, I asked. The gerbil told me it was narrower than she was. Not a problem for tunnel dwellers such as myself, she said. "Truth be told, I like a tight fit." She glared at the bikini top, then added, within reason. Just as I realized the gerbil's potential value, I heard a beating of wings and turned to see my sister standing behind me. A moment later, my brother landed. "What have we got here?" he asked. "Looks like a mouse with a messed up tail," said my sister. "Or a little squirrel, maybe, that was rained on." "Actually, I'm a gerbil," the gerbil said. I wasn't expecting her to join the conversation, but hearing her voice, so full of pride and sass, made me feel right about sparing her. "If you've never come upon one of me before, it's because I'm not native to this area. I'm," and she said the greatest thing, "invasive." My brother moved a step closer to my sister and asked if that was another word for dressed up. "I'm pretty sure, yeah," she answered. The gerbil looked from one of them to the other. Then she turned to me. "Wow, these two are stupid," she said. "No dumber than hamsters, I'll grant you that, but you hear about owls and automatically think brainy." "That's just a myth," I told her. And then, before my dumbfounded brother and sister, I grabbed the gerbil in my right talon and took off. Figuring my family would probably come looking for us, I flew past my home and headed to a hen house on an abandoned farm out near the reform school. There I helped the gerbil remove her bikini top and watched as she hunkered down, exhausted, in a pile of hay. It would have been easy for her to run away, but I hoped that she would stay put. More than hoped, actually. I meant to say something to this effect, but then I must have dropped off. It wasn't much later that I awoke, the story of my life since my mate passed away. I get tired, wiped out even, but can't seem to sleep for more than a few hours at a stretch. It's such a weird time to be awake, noon. Spooky, really. There have been a few occasions when, tired of just standing there and hoping to fall back to sleep, I got up and flew around. The dining options were definitely interesting. Lap dogs, ducklings. I even saw an iguana sunning himself on top of a styrofoam cooler. But there was also a lot of traffic and noise. I never liked the world I saw during the day. Then I started hating the one I saw at night and wondered, what's left. What changed things, albeit slowly, was learning. It's like there's a hole where my life used to be, and I'm filling it with information about potatoes, about hot water heaters. Anything will do. These leeches, though, for the first time in memory, I was unable to sleep, not because I was anxious, but because I was excited. To live in a damp, crowded asshole and sing. If these guys don't know the secret to living, I don't know who does. The gerbil awoke just after sunset and busied herself hunting crickets. After that, I took her to a bird feeder where she put away a few dozen sunflower seeds. Then she wiped her mouth and turned to me, saying, "Okay, owl, what's the plan?" A short while later, we were at the zoo, where I introduced her to the hippopotamus. The two hit it off immediately, and within minutes the gerbil was all caught up vis-à-vis the anal parasites. "Fascinating," she said. "And you're telling me they sing?" "I want them out," repeated the hippo. With no hesitation, the gerbil offered to go in after them. "Why not?" she said. "I've been in tighter places, no offense. And if I can't convince him to leave, I can at least find out what their story is." "You would do that for me?" the hippo asked. The gerbil answered that she'd just spent 18 months living in a cage. "When I finally escaped, I told myself that from here on out, I was going to make some changes, try new food, visit exotic places, live a little." I couldn't believe what a good sport she was. I'd have wanted time to mentally prepare, but not her. The only suggestion she made was that we lube her up a little, just to give me a bit more mobility. "You think?" the hippo said. "But what about your fur?" And the gerbil laughed, saying, "This old thing." There was a carousel near the entrance to the zoo. The gears were coated in heavy grease, and after the gerbil had rubbed against them, I returned her to the pen, where we positioned ourselves on the concrete platform. The hippo backed up under my direction, and though it took quite a bit of maneuvering, we eventually got her rectum even with the gerbil. She was just about to crawl in when I felt myself being watched, and looked up to see four pairs of eyes, perfectly round and glinting, from a tree beside the snack hut. My mother was there, my brother and sister, and joining them was, I'm willing to guess, the cousin I'd stood up last night. Then an elderly uncle arrived, then an aunt. I used to think that there were great horned owls and not so great horned owls. I'd put my former mate and myself in the first category, and from that lofty vantage point, we'd look down upon my family. Now they were looking down on me, a son, a brother, a cousin, a nephew, a half-baked know-it-all, standing beside a grease-blackened gerbil at the gaping back door of a hippopotamus. Even discounting the singing leeches, it really was stunning. This trio of newfound friends, so far-fetched, we simply had to be true. The Vomit-Eating Flies. The fly was at the bus station when he saw a man in a sailor suit clutch his stomach. Then he leaned forward in his plastic seat and vomited onto the scuffed linoleum floor. "Son of a bitch," the man muttered, and he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "I just paid $6 for that." There was a bathroom beside the snack bar, and as the man rose unsteadily to his feet and stumbled in its direction, the people on either side of him abandoned their seats, leaving a wide berth for what looked to be an excellent meal. The fly liked the hot lunch, and was just tucking in when a second fly, this one a female, flew down from the ceiling and landed on a narrow peninsula beside him. "What have we got here?" she asked. "Chinese," the male said. The female sighed and picked half-heartedly at a snow pea. "10'll get you 20, it's from the Shanghai Garden," she told him. "I had their pork lo mein once and was in the restroom for 2 days. "Well, I don't mind it," the male said, and he moved from a beef chunk to a sliver of ginger. A If you don't like ethnic, there are some potato chips in here, too, and a grilled cheese sandwich. What kind of cheese? The female asked. If it's American, you can have it. Suit yourself, the male said. By law, they shouldn't even be calling it cheese. That's how tasteless and full of chemicals it is. The female glanced into a slick of digestive juices and saw her face multiplied 100-fold, scowling back at her. Anyway, when it comes to regurgitated food, you really need to consider the source. The class of person or dog or whatever. Take the lieutenant governor and his family, for example, whom I happen to know quite intimately. Do you? The male said. He had no idea what a lieutenant governor was, but out of politeness he made himself sound interested, the way he did when someone spoke about computers or yoga. Oh, yes, said the female. Why, I was practically raised at Old Stony, which is what they call their summer home on the lake. The lieutenant governor's wife, Khaki to her friends, is 2 months pregnant, though that's strictly on the QT, at least until the formal announcement is made. She suffers from the most terrible morning sickness, and her vomit is outstanding. Better than most normal spoiled food, in my opinion. You don't say, said the fly. Her feces were good as well, at least what I could get of them, the female continued. Like most people of good breeding, Khaki uses a toilet, but then some horrible journalist wrote that she'd had a cocaine problem in college, so she defecated into a shoebox. The plan was to mail it to him at the newspaper, and while she pieced together a note, I swooped in for a quick taste. And? Excellent, the female said. The best feces I've ever had, almost like dessert. The fly pointed in the direction of the departure board. If it's sweet you're after, there's a bit of jam smeared on the handrail over near the front door. I also saw a peach pit on the ground next to the trash can. I meant inherently sweet. Spiritually sweet, the female said. It's a quality the lieutenant governor's wife has in spades, as has Monica Van Landingham. The fly looked at her blankly. The actress, Monica Van Landingham, winner of 2 Percy Awards? Sorry, confessed the fly. Well, she's a very important person, the female told him. Extremely important. We met when she was an overnight guest at Old Stony, not more than 5 days ago it was. There was a fundraising ball for the upcoming election. Miss Van Landingham's shoes were too tight, so of course she developed a blood blister, and of course it popped on the brand new ottoman the moment she returned to her room to put her poor swollen feet up. I tried to clean it off before she noticed, but she's quick, Miss Van Landingham. Observant, too, so I got no more than 5 or 6 mouthfuls before she dabbed at it with soap and water. That did nothing to get the blood out, so in the end she blamed it on the lieutenant governor's dog, Chocolate Chip, which may seem dishonest, but isn't really, seeing as he may as well have done it. Such a common breed, the Jack Russell. She picked at a bit of onion. I can't believe you don't know who Monica Van Landingham is. I'm actually more of a barfly, the male told her. Certain sports figures I could maybe recognize, but otherwise I don't have a clue. He wanted to add that he didn't care either. Life was short. With luck, you had maybe 30 days, so what did it matter whose crap you were feasting on? The same was true for vomit and blood blisters. Just eat and shut up about it. That's the way he saw it. Perhaps you've seen Miss Van Landingham on TV, then, the female said. Not on a commercial, she'd never stoop that low, but on the news. You might think that's odd for an actress, but she has opinions, important ones. Just last week, to give you an example, she came out against breast cancer, told the world, hey, I think it's a bad idea. Well, that's great, the fly said. Call me crazy, but I'm against it too, the female announced. I'm against breast cancer and drunk driving and the one where kids in other countries get their feet blown off. And it's not just my association with Khaki and Miss Van Landingham. I'd be against these things anyway. On the other side of the room, a door opened, and from it stepped the janitor with a mop and a rolling bucket. Just my luck, muttered the fly, and he quickened his pace while monitoring the man's progress. Tonight there's a benefit for people who can't count, the female told him. It's black tie and everyone will be there, everyone important anyway. I'm just waiting until it begins. She paused. That's not an invitation, mind you. I just figured you were wondering what someone like me was doing at the bus station. That I was, said the fly, and he watched over her head as the janitor lifted his mop. Especially someone like you with American cheese stuck to her chin. Oh, my God, said the female. How long has that been there? She dipped her front legs into a puddle of grease, and just as she'd begun to wash her face, the mop came down, and the fly took off for the other side of the room, where a woman in a straw hat had placed an uncovered Tupperware dish upon her suitcase. He parked himself on the no-smoking sign above her head and watched while the janitor ruined a perfectly good meal. As for the female, he wasn't going to waste any time feeling guilty. Constant vigilance, that was a fly's motto, and woe be to anyone who let her attention waver, no matter how good-looking she was. He had to give her that, at least. The female had been pretty. If she'd known how to keep her trap shut, he might have upped her to beautiful, but wasn't that always the way with the ladies? For every good quality they possessed, there were two bad ones, whoppers most often, just waiting to be discovered. The male waited another few seconds, and when the woman below him shut her eyes for a nap, he moved a bit closer and saw that what she'd set atop her suitcase was pie, blueberry, and almost an entire slice. A fellow could spend the rest of his life eating a thing like that. He might not finish it, might not even come close, but neither would he grow tired of it, the way he might of vomit or rot or even fresh feces. Such succulent bounty, and all of it for himself. The fly was rubbing his front legs together, just preparing to dig in, when he heard a familiar voice, and looked up to see the female. "Talk about a close call," she said, and she shook a bead of mop water off her wing. "Now where was I?" As the fly bit glumly into his favorite filling, she positioned herself in a sunbeam and resumed her monologue from the vantage point of the upper crust.
This has been an Hachette audio production of Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk. Written by David Sedaris. Read by David Sedaris, Elaine Stritch, Dylan Baker, and Sean Phillips. Executive producer, David Sedaris. Produced by Michelle McGonigal and Maya Thomas. Directed by Maya Thomas. Recorded by Tommy Herron, Richie Romaniello, and Jordan Killiard, Strathmore Publishing, London. Post-production by Tommy Herron. Production assistant, Paul Flores. Original music composed by Paul Clark. Performed by Tony Kiley, drums. Kalina De La Mer, violin. Annie Whitehead, trombone. And Paul Clark, all other instruments. Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by David Sedaris. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.